Welcome to this episode of Wipe Out Tales from the Superyacht Laundry. I am here with Alicia King from Tidal Yachting. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Obviously, for listeners that are just tuning in, I know Alicia. We've known each other for a while. There was definitely some drunkenness in the toilet bowl in on Teeb.
Absolutely. That's where it all starts.
That's where it all starts. So I know you through friends. Friends of friends, actually. The producer of this podcast is a friend of yours as well as mine. But you have got your fingers, we were just talking about, in a number of pies at the moment. I don't know how you're literally surviving working on that many projects at one time. But before we start, let's go back to the beginning. Who is Alicia King and how did she end up on yachts?
Okay, so I joined the Royal New Zealand Navy straight out of school. So
the Navy?
When I was 18, yeah. And back then I thought I was going to be like a diver or something like super intense. But they didn't have any female divers back then.
Where did the idea of going to the Navy come from?
I went to like a careers expo.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea what I wanted to be. And like a lot of my friends, they knew, you know, from their families, they were going to be dentists or doctors or whatever. My family very much like, you do whatever makes you happy. And I was like, I don't know what makes me happy. Because how are you supposed to choose at 15? It's like
no.
So hard, right?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, went to a careers expo, did some press ups. Loved the Navy guys, was like, this is me. What? I'm joining.
What's not to love about Navy guys? Damn it, I should have thought of that.
Yeah, exactly. So I joined at 18 and I joined as a generalist executive officer, which is basically a fancy word for an officer of the watch. And so I did all of my my basic and advanced nav tickets like straight out of school. So I was going to be in the maritime industry no matter what. Like I made a choice. I just didn't realize how that choice was going to affect me now that I'm in my 30s versus what it was pre-20s.
What was that like, you know, obviously, because we obviously spoken to a lot of ladies about joining the yachting industry, but you're going into a military environment at 18. You know, obviously mm-hmm. I've asked what the first impressions of yachting, but what was your first impressions of like the Navy when you went in?
So you know me.
Yeah.
I'm like incredibly vivacious and I also don't like being told what to do, hence my own boss. So
Navy was going to work out just fine.
Yeah. I know, but hindsight's a wonderful thing. When I joined, like that was the thing that I found the hardest is that I felt like I was having my personality ripped from my body. But you learn lots of things at the same time. So although it's really hard and I think that experience actually set me up really well for yachting because everything has to be done in accordance with, you know, standard operating procedures and everything has a level and a standard at which it's required to be achieved. And so you can bring those kind of skill sets and that that really high standard from a military environment into the super yachting industry, a six-star luxury industry.
So how long did you last in the Navy?
So once I finished my officer watch tickets, I specialised in navigation. So I did astro-nav and pilotage. And then I taught at the navigation school for a little bit. And then I left at, must have been 23, just almost 23, so 5 years in total.
Good effort.
Yeah, actually one of those years so when you are on a boat, ship, because otherwise everyone for the Navy will be like, why are you calling them boats? if your vessel goes to sea that day, then it's classified as a sea day. And so one of the years that I was there, I did 365 days at sea.
And wow.
So, yeah, it was a lot. Obviously young, we've discussed this a little bit earlier, you know, you're young, you've got all of this energy, you want to achieve things, and so you just go and do it. And so for me that year, it was, doing the 365 days at sea, and so much leave racked up at the end of it.
Well, yeah. They do let you off eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
Would you recommend it, coming out of school? like looking back now, before we get into the yachting side of things, but like obviously there's lots of kids that do cadetships and all of those kind of things. Would you say it's valuable and worth serious consideration?
So I'm actually going to, that question that you just asked, I'm going to kind of compare it also to yachting because I think that it can be. So when you leave school, or I don't know what you guys call it in the UK, but yeah,
high school.
Yeah, high school for us. Yeah, so when you leave high school, it's kind of like you've stayed until the age of 18 because you want the options of being able to go to university.
Yes.
And so that's when you kind of then have to make a decision in your last year of school as to whether or not you want to continue to study to be whatever it is that you think you're going to be. And for those girls that I went to school with that knew that they were going to be doctors or dentists or whatever, they were like, yep, we're going straight to university. For me, I kind of didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I made that decision. You can, when you enter the Defence Force now, there's the option to go and do a degree, and it's still counted as part of your time within the Navy. So
amazing.
You just go in uniform and whatever. And you could do that then as well. I just opted not to because of the kind of career path that I chose. But I think yachting is kind of similar, except you do it on your own. So some people that have entered the yachting industry go and get a degree first, and then they come in and all they've done is studied.
Yep.
Whereas some people left school, traveled. I'm not saying that the people that studied are not worldly, but sometimes those people that have had different walks of life or have actually been working in a different industry, like, you know, like the police or, you know, even accounting or whatever it is, they come into yachting and they have these transferable skill sets or kind of mentalities that are quite easy to apply. And so sometimes I think, and especially, I know we haven't got into this yet, but with the recruitment side of things, you can get a 20-year-old, you know, let's say 23-year-old that's studied and a 23-year-old that has been working, and they're both in very different places to be able to start their career in the industry.
Well, we will get into that.
Yeah.
I could talk about that for days. So, yeah, when did yachting, like, enter this picture?
So I left the Defence Force because I didn't get the posting that I wanted.
Did you throw your toys out the pram?
Proper.
So not
I was like,
you.
Give me what I want or I am out of here. And they did not, they definitely were like, they called my bluff. But no, so yeah, so I left. And then I didn't really know what I was doing. And then my old navigator, when I was a baby off the watch, he contacted me and said, why don't you come over to Antibe and try out yachting? And I'm like, okay. Although I feel like, I don't feel like I'm that old, but when you look back, like it was quite a while ago now that, you know, I started 10 years ago that I started in the yachting industry. And so I was like, what do I do? And he's like, well, you just buy a ticket over here and you'll figure it out when you get here. Because it's basically how it started. But now there's all these things that...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's completely different.
Completely different. You know, there's so much, so many tools people can utilize now to get into the industry. But I don't even think I looked for a job for like the first 4 weeks. I think I just enjoyed being in the crew house.
where did you flow into on Antibes?
I flew into Nice, yeah, and then just hung out at the crew Grapevine and on team for like 4 weeks, and they're like,
were
you trying to get a job
portside or seaside?
I was seaside.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, seaside.
I'm spiritually portside, like that place was the second home for me. And there is a rivalry only because we used to do, like, Jen and Jason are amazing, like they do events and stuff, so it's always portside against seaside.
Yeah.
So like wherever you went, you were like, who are you?
And if you had to
move, where are you staying?
And if they said that like your room wasn't going to be available any longer and you had to move houses, you're like,
no.
I'll sleep on the couch downstairs until a room becomes available.
Thanks. I'm not changing.
Yeah.
I'm this far away from getting a tattoo.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually part of the furniture now.
Yes. Yeah, it's quite funny. I mean, you know, I suppose so your first impressions of yachting were Antibes.
Yeah, on team hardcore, yachting hardcore. That's what it is though, right? So it's like, and also it's like everyone acts like they've got money.
Yeah.
So it becomes like quite fun because you're catching the Le Petit train to Juan Lepin to go to Moraya, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was a beach club.
And it doesn't exist anymore.
Nah.
What?
I know. I was gutted. But you know, like those were like the best days of, you know, going down to the toilet bowl, which is a beach for
we basically go to the supermarket, buy your €5 bottle of rosé.
Which is bougie.
It is bougie. Okay. But nobody could drink that colour that was like €3, like it was like Ribena. So we treat ourselves, go €5 and go job hunt on our phones whilst laying on the beach.
What are you doing? Dog walking.
I never dog walk.
Really?
Yeah, no, I never dog walked. I'm too old. When I came into the industry, I was 30, and there's all these kids in their skorts and skirts, and I'm like, no, just no. I'm just, you know, hopefully my CV will get me a little bit further. And, you know, they used to come back a bit deflated. Nobody would speak to us. I'm like, I'm not doing that. I should just stay online and be available from my position on the beach.
Yeah.
So you're in on tape, going to Drinkers and Hop Store and
and all the places.
But you eventually got a job.
Yeah, I eventually got a job, which surprised me the most actually. So it was on a 30-meter wally, and I don't know how to sail, as the mate.
Right.
And tender driver rotational. So it was like, it was myself and this other guy. He was a very good sailor. And we were basically going to take turns between the yacht and the chase boat. It was like a 15-meter wally chase boat.
So let me get this right. You can navigate the boat, but you can't actually get it to move.
Well, I was
under
like
sail.
Yeah. So they were like, "Don't worry, like there'll be plenty of time for that. We'll teach you everything you need to know." And like, to be fair, it was more like, if we were on charter, I would be chase boat. Or if the owner was on, I'd be in the chase boat. And, you know, so just so that he also got some time off. But, like, the engineer and everyone knew how to sail except for me. I was like, why not? This sounds great. Let me try this lifestyle. So I went to a yard period straight off the bat. And that kind of lasted for, like, a few months. And then the reason that they actually got me on board was for to do the nav for the regattas.
Oh, wow.
But again, like I said, because I'm not required to sail, I just have to tell them when to turn or tack. Okay, I'm not a sailor. so anyway, and then the first time that we went to sea, it was super windy and we're sailing and the swell was huge. And when I say huge, like it was big for that size of a vessel, noting that I had never been on a ship that was less than 55 meters. Prior to joining the yachting industry.
So your first impressions of yachting was?
I'm not a sailor, and I quit. but the captain was an absolute legend, and he was like, nah, totally, we get it. Like, I was so sick. Like, I literally felt like I couldn't function. And, like, I've already done 5 years at sea before this, and thought
this to myself, is a different kind of movement, though.
Oh, yeah. Hat off to all the sailors out there because they're a different type of people. So that was my first kind of thing. And then when I left the Royal New Zealand Navy, my qualifications that I got in the Navy are not accepted in civilian street, but my sea time was. So when I came back into yachting, I decided, or when I joined yachting, I decided that the only way for me to continue on the deck side of things was for me to go and get my yacht master.
Right.
So there's two different types of yacht masters. You can kind of do your zero to hero, which is over, I think, it might be 6 weeks or 6 months or something like that. And then there's one if you've got the sea time where it's just a week. And so you go and do a week in the classroom and then a week at sea on a 15-meter boat.
But was it like intense for you, or you actually had tons of foundation knowledge? It was quite easy to do in a week. That sounds quite intense.
Oh, the yacht master?
Yeah.
No. At my level of knowledge and having come straight out of the Navy at that point, I found it quite easy. But I mean, when you don't use it, you lose it. So I still try and keep as much, I still try and have good discussions about navigation and being lost to watch as much as I can with other people that still do it, but as I'm alluding to, I obviously don't do that anymore.
So what deck did you go on after your interesting experience with sales?
So I moved between a couple of boats, and I went on board a 42-meter Tasman called Tatty with Alex Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was chief stew, and I went on board as mate. And then through however fate would have it, I basically ended up, the captain ended up leaving, and I ended up taking over. Although it was for a very short period in Dubai, and then we had the vessel shipped to Palma, and then we did a reefer in Palma. And through that experience of being mate in a female mate in Dubai, and also just the way that from that experience and a couple of other short contracts that I had, how yachts of that size operated, and knowing that I couldn't go any higher because I'd have to start from scratch again. I was like, I can't see myself working on vessels that are under 200 ton as a captain. You don't have the support structure and et cetera that I was used to having in the Navy. Things didn't run the same.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't as structured. And so a lot of things fell through the cracks, especially if you're working on a private boat versus commercial.
I heard that boat was quite challenging at times.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I mean, as a female member of the bridge, I would say, working out in Dubai, how did you find that?
So while we were there, we had the Dubai International Yacht Show. And before that, no problems, because everyone, all the crew were super cool. They were really good and really supportive. And so when the captain left, he left before the Dubai International Yacht Show, so everyone really stepped up into the level above them. And, the girls were outside doing washdowns, and, his crew from the other boats were coming over and giving us a hand because it was on display for the show. Everything was fine. It was a little challenging trying to organise berths and things like that, because people would prefer to talk to the male mate as opposed to me in regards to that organisation. And so that then put a lot of pressure on him, who's already stepped up. And we've all basically had to step up into a role that we're super unfamiliar with. And then he then has to also kind of basically do a lot of the things that the captain would have organized, and so that was challenging. But then at the show, when we were showing people through the vessel, it was basically said from the brokers that I wouldn't be taking anyone through, and that I could attend the walkthrough, and if there was questions, they would ask the engineer or the mate, and I was just there. So that was quite a hard
It's quite an interesting experience out in Dubai, on a vessel. I suppose, like you said, it really does depend on your crew, what your experience is like. Yeah. I was on a vessel out there, and my crew was, they're amazing and everything, but I didn't feel very comfortable. As a Western woman, and you like, to get things done, and do you know what I mean? I found it very frustrating.
So within my first week of joining the boat, so this is the other thing as well, is that as you progress through yachting, you become more aware of the visas that are required to travel.
Yeah.
And, and you learn more about SEA agreements, which is your seamanship employment agreement. And you are aware of what your rights are in accordance with MLC, the Maritime Labour Convention. And so you just have this arsenal of knowledge. But when you're first starting, and like I said, I'd only been on a couple of short stints prior to that boat. And within the first week, we got our passports taken off us.
Lovely.
I was like, no, you're not taking my passport. But the captain at that point handed them over. And so, yeah, that was a huge red flag for me. I was like, what's happening here?
Because I think people, I'd love to do an episode on the Middle East and stuff like that. It is lovely and it can be really, really good. But I just, you know, for me, some things just weren't sitting quite right. And it's the frustration. You know, as a female from the West, you kind of have all of these freedoms. Yes. I think that was the first time I'm like, what? Women don't function in the same way everywhere on the planet. Like, why would you not?
But also, not only am I a female, but I'm a female with two
sons. Yeah, you're also.
So it's like.
Yeah, but you're also trying to be in the typical male environment as well, which in Palmer could be tricky, you know, but nowhere near the same, you know, same kind of level.
Yeah, so I've got tattoos on both my arms and I've got tattoos on one of my legs as well. And so I used to wear long pants and the long sleeve t-shirt every single day in 44 degree heat.
Nice.
Yeah.
But you smell great.
Right, yeah, exactly. but also like it wasn't until the wife was like, oh, don't worry about it. They're not, like, I don't find them offensive. You can wear shorts and a t-shirt. And I was like, oh.
The tattoo thing is a real, like, I remember, you know, when I was trying to get a job. So for listeners out there, I have a tattoo on my wrist. That is basically the sign of the devil as far as recruiters are concerned. Well, they were in back in my day. She's got a visible tattoo. You can't even put her forward. They'll hate her.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I, like you said, like once your boss gets, like, no, they don't seem to be bothered. So I'd really like to know where this visible tattoo standard really
came from
because, you know, I've got, you know, lots of people out there that have got a visible tattoo, but when trying to get in the industry, it was like, you've got this visible tattoo, you've got to cover it up. You're like, I was working on the interior, you can't cover that up with makeup. Like, do you know how many pillowcases I would like ruin?
Exactly.
So I got around it, I wore my watch on the wrong arm. Because obviously then
so
I got the hugest diesel watch. It's like a bracelet. Oh, yeah. Like, it's massive. Even it. Because they won't like it and they just didn't care. Didn't care. Like,
I actually met a stewardess once and I'm this is a true story, and she was tattooed from here.
Oh, you have to explain.
So, from basically, yeah, like if you would have like a chin strap. So she, from her chin all the way down to her toes, on all her hands, the whole lot. Like, I never saw underneath her uniform, but she was fully tattooed. And no one cared. Bottom cared. She was so good at her job. That, for me, was like, that's crazy that you got a job.
Because you're told the opposite all of the time.
Correct.
I even got asked in an interview, would I get it lasered off? I'm like, what? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's real, really, like, you could probably stay in the job if you get your tattoo lasered off. I'm like, I just, my brain could not cope with it. And to be honest, thinking back to that when I was kind of in a bit of a, you know, obviously, because you want a job. I'm like, am I emotionally attached to it? Like, I got my tattoo in Australia when my life changed a lot.
Yeah.
And it was just to remember. Like, it's not like I got drunk. I decided to tattoo my wrist.
I've done that.
Literally, like, it meant it was just something that I needed to remember on a daily basis, because otherwise my life was not going to change. So I'm like, am I going to get that lasered off for a job?
No. But I think that's also, like, kind of touching on quite a valuable thing that should probably be talked about, is that yachting, people can really get in a trance when they're in yachting.
Yep.
And they can kind of lose themselves and their identity and their core values. Yep. And you just need to, like, take a step back sometimes and be like, what the fuck? That's ridiculous. Absolutely not. I'm not going to do that. Like, because that is ridiculous.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And it shouldn't be asked of people. But the industry and the way that they, you know, boats do ask for people that are 6 foot tall that are blonde with blue eyes.
And 10, so, well, 10, size 10 or 8 if you're really good.
Or 6.
No, I was literally talking to a lady the other day about Chief Stew. She's 6 foot, so she can't fit in a size 10. Not because she's fat, because she's 6 foot.
Yeah.
Like, I'm fine.
These around the boat.
Do you know what I mean? And the score is literally like, you know, it's not realistic, you know, because I've heard stories of boats buying uniform, and if you don't fit in the uniform, you can't work on board. So that was their gauge.
That was it.
To see whether you're overweight.
Yeah. So like I remember going to a boat and like it was US size 4, which is like the equivalent to a 6 to 8. And they didn't have anything bigger than that on the boat. And when I joined yachting, I was much bigger than I am now because I just ate croissants and pastries every day.
At the toilet bowl.
Yeah, every day. And drank vino for 6 weeks. And so I went from like this person that was like 63 kilos to 73 kilos. And then I decided I was going to try and get a job in the yachting industry. And then I very quickly lost all of that weight. You know, but I hear as well, like I hear about boats that are putting their stewardesses on diets and watching, you know, and I just think that's ridiculous and that's not fair.
It is ridiculous.
Being
but...
healthy isn't. I mean, the chefs should provide healthy food.
Yeah.
But, it, you know.
It's a lot of pressure on an individual, but it's not an isolated industry.
Yeah.
Because I know having a friend on as an air stewardess, they used to have to before shift go into a room and be weighed before they started work. Their uniform was checked and they were weighed before they started work. I'm like, well, once a month I'd be over. Do you know what I mean?
No, like, totally. Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna
be at least 2 kilos heavier through the want of eating ice cream. And water retention.
Yeah, exactly. You'd be like, try and tell me I'm 2 kilos heavier.
Yeah. So could you give me, you know, your high, like from working on yachts, can you give me one moment where you're like, this is amazing?
So when the owner said to me, you can step up, we're not going to go out and advertise a job for a captain, that for me, I felt a lot of trust there because I actually hadn't been on that long and I was being really well supported by the chief steward and everyone. That for me was a high at that point, even though that high turned into a like career burner and a change of career for me. But also that was kind of good because although I was still in the maritime industry, I went and got a job as a chef on a yacht. And then for me, I was like, actually, I can do this. I can shift and I can change and I can be dynamic
That's when I met you. You were a chef.
Yeah.
So I didn't actually know you had any qualifications.
I know. It surprises everyone. Everyone was like, can drive a boat?
She cooks food, no?
Yeah.
Oh, no, she can actually drive one as well. Oh, that's amazing.
So, yeah. And like I said, like the... So the high for me within yachting was knowing that I was, you know, obviously you back yourself anyway, you tell yourself you're fantastic, but I was dynamic enough to change to something that
adaptable.
Was, yeah, and could do it if I put my mind to it, which I did. And then I loved being a chef on board the yachts. So, you know, and I worked for a Russian owner first, which was very interesting.
And the way this is, it's just interesting.
Yeah. There was definitely some stuff thrown around the boat. And then I worked for the same owner for the next couple of years, pretty much until I was thinking about leaving.
I always had a lot of respect for chefs, but you know, on one of my boats, we had a Russian, guest and he ate lunch and he just sat there and had food all afternoon with his friends and then went into dinner service. So the chef
was just constantly
serving food for like 7 hours because we didn't even have breaks to change the table or anything. It was just more food, more food, more food. I'm like, wow.
How's that guy's metabolism there?
Well, he came on really slim and when he left, like there was this like... this pooch.
Win in Rome.
So obviously when he goes on holiday. But that was like, you know, I thought, wow, as a chef, like, because you've got no prep time.
No prep time.
He's literally eating, like, they just ate, drank vodka and ate, and then we went into dinner. So I was like, do you want to take a break? You know, go do some stuff. No, serve dinner. I'm like, what? You've just...
Yeah, I think the expectation as well is that, like, people that don't prepare food sometimes forget just how hard it is. So, like, you know, I've had jobs where the galley's been out of action for, like, ventilation and to have the flooring ripped out, and the expectation is that you'll cook for 26 crew on a barbecue, on a Weber. You know, it's just not. It's pot, obviously, I did it. But
because I'm amazing.
Yeah, that's what I said, fucking legend. No, just, but the, yeah, and then you've also got, you know, owners that come home at 2 a.m. in the morning and they're like, I want a toasted sandwich or whatever. And
so,
and so
classic.
Stewie comes and gets you to make a fucking toasted sandwich. You're like, bro, I'm pretty sure you could have made the toasted sandwich. But anyway, so, you know, it's just, it's diverse.
So obviously you're having best time, but when did it change on board? When did you go, maybe this is not for me anymore?
Yeah, so when I went from the same owner, 45 metre, to the 63 metre, that was quite a change. There was lots of new faces, which was great because I love change and I love making new friends. But when that crew started to leave and started to change, and the dynamic on board, the vibe of people and everything, and then what happened is we basically had nearly a full crew change out like three times within a couple of months.
No, it's really unsettling.
And it, yeah. So, and when that happened, I just thought to myself, you know, if you're in a good thing, it's okay. But when you have to keep changing that good thing, and my high turns into a low because it's changing so often, for me, I thought, well, what am I going to do next?
Yeah.
You know, like I didn't, and I kind of find myself in like kind of 5 year waves. So I did 5 years of the Navy and I'd done 5 years in yachting. And I was like, now what?
So now what? So did you have an exit strategy? Did you have a plan?
So, yeah, I did actually. So what I did is when I left that boat, I just got like a job looking after a little boat in Antibes. And it was just for like the winter. So that was really easy. So that was income. I had a place to live and I didn't need to. And I could have time to figure out what is that I wanted to do next. Cause money is always good. And then in that time I started doing, I think at the time I thought the only way to go was to start a recruitment company because that's what women that leave yachting do.
That's that's what I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna start a recruitment company.
And so I used that winter time to contact accountants, to talk to dive into the Maritime Labour Convention, to kind of start to understand what was gonna happen with my taxes when I went home.
Back to New Zealand.
Yeah. So there's like, and like if you sit down, and I mean, there's no list of things that you have to do when you leave the yachting industry. But there is a few things that, like those things that I just was discussing, that you should be aware of. And it's always good. It's always good to talk to somebody that has done it to be like, can I learn from your lessons learned?
Yep.
Which I didn't have really, and everyone was kind of like, oh well, we just did it. But I'm a bit of a planner. And then I plan and then the plan goes out the window and I just kind of run with it. So yes, I did have a plan and it did take ages and my plan didn't exactly pan out like I thought it would either.
So when did you go back to New Zealand?
2017. Yeah. Or 2018, something like that. I think I've had my company now for 6 years.
Right. And how was it start? So you're fresh. Like, this is going to be amazing. It's going to work.
Yeah. So I registered the company in November 2017. And then from there, you know, your accountants say what your tax liabilities are, blah, blah, blah. And you're learning how to, not only are you the marketing agent, not only are you the software developer, not only are you this, that, and the other thing. All of my money that I left yachting with was sunk into this thing that I believed that I could do. And I am a type of person that if I put my mind to something and say I'm going to do it, I will do it. But it was just a really long process of learning and falling and picking myself back up And so when tidal yachting very first started, we were a maritime labour convention compliant recruitment company, and we were the second MLC compliant recruitment company in New Zealand.
Wow.
So now there's like 12 or 15 of them.
They copied your idea.
And well, it's okay. It's okay. I'm happy to share the love. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't recommend going into recruitment. It's a lot because there is no stability in your income.
No. And you've got to be good at, but like, so I, many, many years ago, I did recruitment. And I was really good at talking to people.
Yeah.
Really good at getting through the door.
Yeah.
You know, talking to companies, selling the dream. Could not close for, I just couldn't close. Because my boss was like, you're amazing, but you've got to try and convince these people to take the job. I'm like, but I don't want to make the decision for their life. Like, literally, yeah. I'm the worst recruiter ever. I'm like, it's their decision.
That's peer pressure. I don't want to peer pressure anybody.
He was like, but that's, you know, it's not like you're forcing people to take jobs they don't want, but you do.
No, yeah.
But you kind of are in some respects if
you feel responsible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't cope with it. So, yeah, I was the worst recruiter ever. So you were back in New Zealand. You're an entrepreneur. How's that feel?
I was an entrepreneur that had to go back to waiting tables and flipping burgers for $17 an hour because the highs were highs and the lows were lows. And so
feast or famine, and very easily.
Yeah, totally. And obviously because you're yachty, when you're feasting and everything's very bougie and you're loving it. And then you very quickly realize that like you have to pay rent and power bills and this, all of this stuff that you didn't have to do when you were in yachting. And so, I mean, if I could give advice to people, I would be like, do your research now while you are in yachting about what you can do with your money. Everything, insurances, buying houses, mortgages, correct, putting money away for yourself for a later day, and I'm so glad that I did that when I was in yachting because... I put a little bit aside, let's not get too crazy, let's not get too crazy here. But I definitely didn't buy a house or anything in yachting. Like I should have, but I didn't. I just pissed my money up against a wall traveling and
great
doing,
time.
I had the best time. So
but it is that, you know, when you're in it and living it, you know, I was completely the same when it comes to finance, like the plan ahead, you know, and that's obviously what we do. Our advice for pals is when I say plan your exit when you get in, that's not like know what job you're going to do. Mm. It means if they make you do it on land, so if they make you pay into a pension, if you were at home, pay into a goddamn pension. Do you know what I mean? Pay your national insurance, depending on your country, so you get your healthcare and all of those kind of things. And then maybe tuck a little bit away and, you know, save it. And then spend the rest on rosé.
Yeah, I also think in the yachting.
You know, like, if you tick all of those, like, three, whilst you're having the best time of your life, you won't notice that money is doing what it's doing because you'll still be able to spank the lot. And mum and dad will be like, mum, I'm paying into my pension, my savings, and I've got my like health insurance, and you know, I've got all of these things, and I've paid into like Nautilus, so I've basically got employment lawyers on tap. If I get into trouble, I'm just going to buy whatever I want with the rest. I've earned it, and I think that's fair.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've got a daughter, so if she actually did that, I haven't got a leg to stand on to moan at her because, you know, that's
her thing. But then I think as well, like, when I first joined the yachting industry back in the day, we're sitting here having this discussion, being like, let us teach you, learn from our mistakes or learn from the things.
Don't do what we did.
Correctly. Yeah, correct. Too much rosé. But I also think that money and funding in some cultures and from some countries is a really taboo thing to talk about.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'm not saying that you need to tell people how much money you have, but there are people in the industry now, and there are things available to people that are in the industry where they can go and talk about how they should be
yep.
looking
Stay
out.
Safe.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, that's a really good, where were we before that?
You were flipping burgers.
Yeah. So I was flipping burgers and going through the highs and the lows, and then and just like trying to get to as many events as I possibly could. So, and obviously like I did something that's so very different, because the Southern Hemisphere, we do have like quite a lot of super yacht service providers and provisioners. They're just not very well known, which has led me on to one of my other ventures. But so for me, it was doing something, I was doing something so daunting in an area where there wasn't a lot of support. And then over the first couple of years of my career, and the more I got out there, I realized that actually people were very supportive of me and what I was trying to achieve. And then we ended up getting the largest boat. We started doing agency work and got the largest yacht into New Zealand during COVID.
Oh, wow.
And did refit on her, you know, so the things continue to expand and expand. And so Tidal Yachting went from being a recruitment company that didn't have a steady income, to an agency and management company and project management company.
Go you.
So yeah, it's been the highs and lows, man. Like that, it is real. As a, you have to just be mentally prepared that some days are going to be fantastic, and then other days will be frustrating, and you will go through a whole range of emotions, but you have effectively just gone into a long-term relationship with whatever company you've created. And that company for me has led me, and the things that I've been attending in the South Pacific led me to meet my business partners. So I ended up selling half of my company and diversifying out. So it's now called Tidal Maritime. And we do like proposals for defense, and we do work in the water space development areas of like dredging and building wharves and things
so
like that.
So it's expanded amazingly. Yeah. And when you were back flipping burgers, yeah, you were just like, is this actually going to work?
Yeah, I remember a guy came in that was building yachts in Thailand to get a coffee one day. And I started chatting to him, and at that moment while I was flipping burgers, I was like, I've got to make change, and I've got to do it right now. And my dad had been watching the kind of scene in New Zealand and where it was going when I came back. And he said that the hard stand in Tauranga, which is the Bay of Plenty for those of you in New Zealand that don't know, was about to open. And so I went and saw the guy who was running that and said, can I be here? Can I be in this precinct? Can I be a part of it? And he said that there was lots of walls that were up, but then he actually brought me into his team doing administration so that I could be close to it. And so then I stopped flipping burgers, went into administration, getting paid three times as much, went into operations, and then I took over driving the travel lift. So it was a 350-ton travel lift and was the operations manager for the haul out yard.
So you would agree. So I've changed my name recently to Charisse Pivot.
Yeah.
Because being an entrepreneur, you know, you do hit dead ends. Like, and you're like, oh, like this is not working. It's not how I imagined it. Right. Okay. What do I do next? And if it's not quite working, what's your advice?
Yeah. So talking to other people is really important, and having a support network for yourself, because, and whether that is other females or males, like and you just gotta, I'm a real ideas person, and I have these ideas and I follow them through, but sometimes to my own detriment. And so if you're going to change, you need to kind of make sure that you're going to stop, smell the roses, and understand what that's going to take from you if you do that pivot before you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and do the plan. And as you do more business, you'll understand, like, it gets a lot quicker. But sometimes that pivot can take a little while.
Pivot.
Such a pivotal word there. But the, yeah, so, and changing is okay, as long as I think you also need to understand whether, so like me going into the yard, I was still doing tidal yachting. But I was working at the yard 2 or 3 days a week, which then turned into working at the yard 7 days a week because it was all going towards my goal. And if I hadn't have done that, I wouldn't be where I am now. It all went through title. We were a contractor. We did all of these things. You know, like there, you can be creative and fluffy with the way that you do your work.
Entrepreneurial journey is not pretty. That's what I'm kind of learning. You know, in your head when you're doing your plan, it's not anywhere near what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
But that doesn't matter. You know, it really is, you know, it really is sink or swim. So if you're obviously talking directly to the ladies that are listening in the laundry right now, mm-hmm. or in the galley, what would your, and they've got an idea.
Yeah.
They've got an idea, but it's not recruitment.
yeah. And even if it is, that's okay. I'm just telling you, it's a hard slog.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there. What would your 3 bits of advice be to it right now?
Okay. So my first would be that it's okay to still be working while you're trying to figure out the ins and outs of what the next step. So your idea, how does my idea expand? How do it plan? How does it affect me? Assure, how am I going to do it? Creating your exit strategy and talking to other people about it. It's okay to still be working on board whilst you're doing that. But I would, my very first piece of advice would be, once you decide to do it, just go and fucking do it. So you made your plan, you've put your plan in place, and then you leave.
Yep.
So I made myself a rule that I wouldn't go back to sea once I'd started it for 5 years. And a couple of weeks ago, I went back on board a boat for like 10 days and did some chefing. And I was like, oh my fucking God, I'm so glad that I left this. What was I thinking? Like, I work some long hours now. But I love it. Like, I love what
I do. Doesn't feel like that.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're going to leave, put your plan in place and just leave. Don't keep dipping the foot back in because it's so much harder. It's so much harder. And also because your brain power and your energy is split.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you might be thinking, oh, but I'm on rotation. It doesn't matter. You're still a yachty.
You're in.
Yeah, you're still in. So use your time on your rotation, off your rotation, to set the foundations. It's actually, you're probably even in a better situation because you can go home and talk to the accountants. You can register your company. You can understand how much that costs every year and things. So that would be my number one piece of advice would be, if you're going to do it, leave, make the plan and talk to other people. Because, and do your research, because there is so much out there now that we didn't have.
No.
I'm not saying that we were hindered or anything, but it was just different. And, you know, the same rules don't apply in all countries.
No. I think that we're in a different time as well. There is a unique opportunity now because of, the internet and everything else, that you could go into something, and that's what I'm finding. After talking to hundreds of ex-crew members now, female crew members, there is a unique opportunity now to step off and, live even a better life than your time on board. And I'm hoping this obviously the podcast can get the juices flowing for a lot of ladies. You can step off. You're going to have a little bit of capital. You could step off. Your passion becomes your job, which means your job is no longer a job. It's, you're living your best life. I think it's more, there's more chance of it happening now than ever before.
Totally. And so a lot of women are influenced by the fact that they want to have children,
or that
captains think that they should have had them already. And so they're like, well, she's going to leave soon because she's going to have kids. And I'm not saying that to all captains, because there's lots of very supportive and amazing captains out there. But that was the mentality when I was exiting, yep. is that I thought I was going to have children, and then my children became my business. And that's what it is. But you also don't have to leave yachting. I'm talking about this as an entrepreneur and business owner, but you don't have to be that. You can leave and go and work for someone that's already done it, or you could, like, there, you know, if you were going to go and be a charter broker, or you were going to be an owner's representative or a client manager or whatever that might be, you can talk to people about it.
Doing that beforehand.
Yeah.
So before we wrap this up, 5 years from now, what are you doing? How big's the empire? You like 5-year plans. Where is
Alicia? I love a 5-year plan. So actually, no joke. So when I first started in the Navy, I used to write myself a 5-year plan. They make you do it. And I still do it. Whoa. So I have short-term, long-term goals. The empire has expanded. So, yeah, we have Tidal Maritime, which trades as Tidal Yachting. And then we have Yacht Graphic, which does 3D CAD file design and rendering. And we do virtual reality walkthroughs of boats that haven't been built yet for the owners. And we have just created a yacht configurator, which allows us to change all of the aspects, like couches, bench tops, carpet, whatever, in real time while the owner's in VR. Yeah. So as far as we're aware, we're the first to market the open market with it. So any builder can use us, any like interior design person, whatever. We've started with yachts, but we know that we have the ability to go into private planes and both commercial and residential real estate. Obviously, we're not the first ones to do CAD and rendering. It's just the configurator, which kind of sets us apart from everybody else. So we're very much pushing ahead with that. And then we are also about to launch Alliance Pacific, which is an alliance of companies, service providers, product providers in the South Pacific. And we basically have, it's like Google Maps for yachts that are coming down. So you have access to weather, local weather, you have access to local cruising routes, you've got access to local information, and you've got access to the local providers. And there's some really cool things. We've been walking around the south of France and Italy and America, and now we're in Parma.
Because yachts are going further than they've ever been before. Correct, you know? Yeah. So, and I have lived in New Zealand. I would highly recommend it. I would have stayed there if I was an orphan, but I'm not.
Yeah.
But I would highly recommend it. So just a little bit of a message to any Kiwi girls that are listening to this podcast. There are options for them when they go home to still stay connected to the yachting industry, so they don't have to like hang up their squats and then go work on a farm.
Yeah, and that's correct. And it's not just like New Zealand either. So we're talking about Australia, Fiji, Tahiti. Like we're seeing more, people from these areas are joining the industry, but likewise, people from those areas are leaving. And like myself are creating these businesses. And so there is more opportunity. It's just not as widely known about. So hopefully we can help people see the providers that we have down south and know that some of us have done it. So reach out, and we really do try and support other business owners that are coming through. Mm-hmm. We actually sponsor each year an upcoming business to go to the Super Yacht Gathering in Auckland.
Oh, amazing.
To try and get them chit-chatting and to try and get those, you know, the diversity and the creative juices flowing and things like that. It's a small industry. I mean, how many people are in the yachting industry worldwide? Probably like 80,000 or something like that.
I think across the world, those that work in it and are associated to it, I think it were 250,000.
Oh yeah, totally.
Like total, and I think there's like 70,000 to 80,000 that work on boats.
Yeah.
At this particular moment in time, and then it breaks down to like 25,000 of those are women. I've done some stats.
Yeah. Exactly. But it's stats. You know, but if you
it's a little bit early. I haven't had a coffee yet.
Yeah. I'm running on tea. So there's lots of opportunities, and like you need to find your thing.
Well, I would love to come down to New Zealand for Puzzle Wisdom work stuff. So we can try and get everybody together on the island, ex-crew community of females, and see what's going on down there. That's me putting out to the universe for 5 years.
Yeah.
I actually get to go out and about a bit further afield. So before we finish, I always ask, could you tell me a crazy story from your time at sea?
You know, I was literally dreading this because I thought to myself, so I'm really like either super vanilla or like...
That's not what I remember.
Or, yeah, correct. Yeah, that's where I was going. So it's like, I'm either one or the other, and there's no middle ground here. I literally, so like I said, I went on board the other day for a couple of days to do some shipping and was like, what the fuck am I doing? And there were so many stories that came out during that time, and I just can't remember any of them.
So PC.
Yeah, I know.
So PC.
So chefs are notorious in the yachting industry for being quite heavy-handed, as in, like, always being the ones that are either alcoholics or drunk. A lot of the time.
Where's the mug?
And
it's the mug.
Yeah.
It's the mug. Yeah. It's the mug in the galley that's not got coffee in it.
Yeah.
Or it's sorry, chefs. It's not just divulge your secret.
Or it's not got coffee, but it's got like Kahlua and a little bit of coffee, and it's basically an espresso martini in a mug at 6 a.m. in the morning. And anyway, I was discussing this. One of the guys that used to work with me on a certain boat, which I now won't say what it is, he works with me now as a project manager for us, and he's here with me in Palmer at the moment. Yeah. And so we were discussing like crazy stuff that's happened on board, and we had a head chef at the time, and he was with the purser. And when they both left, which happens, right, one gets fired and the other one then feels like they have to go at the same time. And anyway, so they left. And then when the girls were cleaning the cabin out, they literally found about like 100 bottles of vodka, empty bottles of vodka throughout the cabin.
Whoa.
And so we were just thinking to ourselves, we're like, well, was it the chef or was it both of them?
Yeah, but surely you just get rid of one periodically. You don't leave them all in there.
I know. So basically under both of the bunks was just full vodka. And like vodka's like, I'm like, you're not cleaning with it.
Well, no, you're not cleaning with it. But that's like...
A lot.
That's like hardcore drinkers. Like obviously we had good times on rosé, but like vodka...
That's functioning alcoholic.
Yeah, no, that's massively functioning. Well, kind not really functioning.
But I was like, yeah, I think there is two sides to it though as well. Is that like and for me, I had another chef as well that literally used to get so torched that they used to just lean up against the wall to get down to the crew mess. And then one day they missed a step and it was all over, and then they just KO'd at the bottom of the stairs.
Oh my God.
Like, yeah. I mean, there's definitely, if you start poking around, I'd say there's probably some pretty good, just FYI, not a functioning alcoholic. and those stories were not relating to me.
No, but it's the tough, like we said, the chef is the toughest job, you know. When you're a boss on, you've got high pressure, obviously, making sure that you're feeding all of the guests, but also the crew. It's a lot of covers. If you've worked in a restaurant, there's a lot of covers at a high standard. And some chefs are on their own. Like, it's just one person doing all that prep work and service. And, you know, it's quite easy for them to fall into the trap of, you know, I just need something to get me through.
But it wouldn't be accepted if it was any other trade.
Oh, no.
Do you know what I mean?
No.
Like, and it shouldn't be either. For chefs, no matter what. But I think, yeah, again, they are notorious for it. I mean, I don't think I'd be able to even cook anything if I was torched. Like, I'd be like, cheese sandwiches, everybody. yachting's a good crack, though. But sometimes those dynamics change the way that a boat operates as well. And you often find that if you're on those boats, and that kind of thing can actually pressure you to leave anyway.
I remember one chef, I don't remember what his name is, but I just remember that I didn't want to eat his food because I was the laundry stew and he didn't put his whites in every day. So by the time I got them, they were like cardboard. It was the most disgusting thing ever.
That's
like,
so gross.
you know, obviously so much grease and everything else. I was like, and it literally put me off eating his food. I just couldn't do it. I just could not do it any longer. Because it wasn't, like, he just didn't put any washing in.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're wearing the same thing again. Like, you know,
grim.
It's grim if you're a stewardess. Like, it's going to be sweaty. It's possibly doable with, you know, loads of Febreze, but not a chef.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I was washing the galley rags more often than is chef wise. Anyway, we digress. Thank you so much for being part of this podcast. I think your journey has, you know, obviously we've been in touch over the years, but every time I speak to you, you're doing something else. You know, you are literally on the entrepreneurial freight train and it's not going to stop. And it's really nice to speak to somebody from one of my favorite countries in the entire world as well.
In Palma.
And the sun's coming out and, a great show. But no, it's really nice. And I think we could probably do a couple more episodes with yourself talking about your businesses and maybe getting a bit more into the detail of like how you actually create these businesses and how they function.
Yeah.
If you'd be up for it. Sure. I will try my hardest to come to New Zealand.
Yeah,
to
just
do that.
If we sit in really one nice. Every day for a week.
Yeah. So thank you very much for being a part of this.
I appreciate it. I mean, it's like I said, the Yacht Pearls of Wisdom platform and the podcast were not a thing when we started yachting. And so it was quite like isolated. And I think that you thought that what you were going through, you were the only person going through it. Mm-hmm. You're not.
Yep.
There are so many people that have been through it, and that doesn't make it okay, whatever it is that you're thinking about right now while I'm having this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, just know that there are platforms like yours that are there for you all. And so it's great for me to be able to come talk and be like, you can do it.
You can do it.
If you think you can do it, you can do it. So you need to tell yourself that you can do it.
Yep. Thank you so much. We will have you on again. If you're listening to this podcast, thank you very much for joining us. If you want to take this conversation on a little bit further, we will be doing our Thursday night lives. I might even be able to convince Alicia to come on to that. So if you've got any questions you want to ask her directly, you can do that. If you want to be a part of the community, obviously we've got the Pearls of Wisdom app. We talk about all of these topics and a lot more and connect you with some incredible experts. But yeah, it's been a pleasure and we'll see you on the next episode.